From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made the last time you went to the mall. When was it? Was it last week? Last month? Maybe last year? Can you even remember? Presidential candidate Andrew Yang is rolling out a plan to save America's dying malls. Now, not all malls are dying, but many are. The Yang campaign agrees with Credit Suisse, which forecasts that 300 malls will close in the next 4 years alone in this country. That's a quarter of all American malls gone by 2023. And for the malls that survive, many will have to deal with anchor stores shutting down as well. So Yang has put forward the American Mall Act, a plan to devote $6 billion federal dollars to finding new purposes for dying malls. Here in the Rochester area, Wilma Wright has said that Eastview Mall is going strong, while Marketplace Mall in Henrietta could see a serious repurposing sometime soon. Cynics point out that Andrew Yang released his plan in Columbia Place, a withering shopping hub in South Carolina, one of the early voting states. Was he pandering? Well, Yang says this is not about forcing malls to stay open artificially. Rather, he says the government should provide matching grants to repurpose the buildings and the vast parking lots, often referred to as gray fields. Yang says something has to happen to prevent these large spaces from becoming sinkholes, both literally and figuratively. This hour, a conversation about what should or should not be done to intervene, to provide new life or death to the American Mall and its adjoining oceans of parking. Producer Megan Mack reached out to Lonely Medley Center on Twitter. I know you didn't. That was a joke, Megan Mack. She's looking at me and said, nobody can get Lonely Medley Center. That's the real get. We're going to have to take with what we can get this hour, and that's just George Conboy, the chairman of Brighton Security. Unless you are Lonely Medley Center. Are you Lonely Medley Center?
I will state categorically I am not Lonely Medley Center, and I was just put ranked below Lonely Medley Center on your hierarchy here.
That's because everyone is below Lonely Medley Center. George, welcome, as always. Howard Decker, it's not you, is it?
No, it certainly is not me,
sir. Howard Decker is a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester and probably not a big fan of massive parking lots. Nice to have you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And with us on the line is June Williamson, Chair of Architecture and Associate Professor in the Bernard and Ann Spitzer School of Architecture at City College of New York. June, welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm just fine. Thanks for having me.
I want to ask all of you about what you think right out of the gate about not just a proposal like this, but sort of the state of malls, because I would gather that nobody wants to see every mall in America or even a quarter of the malls in America just be filled with weeds forever. It's a question of what should and should not be done. How do you see it, George Conboy?
How I see it is let people determine if they want to go to the mall. If we take Wilma Wright's own professed situation, Eastview's going strong. Must be because people are shopping there. That's great. And we look at Medley Center. It's closed. And in Marketplace, that's on the way to the euphemistic repurposing, meaning it's dying. Let it die.
Okay, but let it die means if nothing happens there in the free market, so be it? Or should there be any intervention?
I don't see an intervention. The intervention's called property taxes. If you let the place go fallow and you own it and weeds sprout up, and you get your property tax bill every year, eventually, if you don't maintain the place, if you don't maintain it, we'll condemn it. And if you maintain it, you're going to pay property taxes, and eventually you'll repurpose it or you'll sell it. It'll repurpose itself.
Okay. Howard Decker, how do you see the state of American malls and what should or shouldn't be done?
Well, I have to say at first, Evan, that I'm shocked and gratified that a politician, Democrat, Republican, independent, or otherwise, has actually decided to talk about America's cities and towns. And for that, I'm grateful. Now then, whether or not we need to spend $6 billion on 300 shopping malls, that amounts to about $20 million bucks a piece, is another matter altogether. And I have to say, that I'm skeptical about the value of this program is to put it quite mildly. I'm not sure what this is all about.
The Yang plan.
The Yang plan.
All right. Well, you know, June Williamson is someone who spent a lot of time seeing and looking at the possibilities of what malls can become. What do you make of what we're hearing from Andrew Yang and what we ought to be thinking about American malls, June?
Well, I think it's really was quite surprising to learn that the academic work that I've been doing for a decade or more now, looking at retrofitting suburbia more generally, but a lot of the focus is on retrofitting dead malls, and there are many dozens of examples of successful projects, many of them public-private partnership projects that have already happened. To hear this elevated into the platform of a candidate for the presidency was kind of surprising. And yet, I think if you dig deeper, there's a lot of merit to focusing on these large properties that really have a central location, not only physically, but also in terms of social community life in so many suburban communities across the country.
Well, I mean, I guess they've been centers of community life in the past, but not so if people aren't using them anymore. Is that right, June?
Well, I think some of the things that's already been happening in terms of repurposing that have happened with public subsidy, a lot of it local through public-private partnerships, in part because a mall has failed, and it's deemed so central, and there's nowhere else to go. So putting in different kinds of uses, not retail-oriented uses, more locally serving uses, is already happening because they are kind of a gravity center. And when they're not there, it really is a loss.
Yeah, this is what's interesting this hour. There's very few people, if any, that I've encountered who are talking about saving malls in the ways that we have grown up with malls. I mean, I think there is a general understanding that malls are going the way of the phone booth eventually. To which, by the way, I said to a team of soccer players who were 7 years old the other day, you guys are all crowded. It's like you're stuck in a phone booth. And they gave me a blank stare. No one had any clue what I was talking about. Well, in the future, the next generation might not really know what malls were, and maybe that's the case. But June, what have you seen malls become? What should we be thinking about?
Well, there are so many examples, and I think the larger narrative here is that these large shopping malls, and I think at the peak mall in the 1990s, we had around 1,500 regional and super-regional shopping malls around the country, and one could say that every city in the U.S. had a mall or two malls or a dozen malls or more at that time, there's been a real transformation. But I think we have to remember that a lot of those malls were built with direct and indirect, indirect federal subsidy through accelerated depreciation in the tax code, which was adopted in 1954, accelerated down to 7 years, the write-off on these properties. So they were often built, as historians have demonstrated, with relatively sort of cheap or non-durable construction, and with really an idea of getting that profit quite quickly, and also a lot of the investment came through pension funds, and a lot of them were public pension funds. So to say that they all came about through private demand, I think is not historically accurate. So it's interesting to really think about all the other possible uses that could go in them in a locally serving way. So whether it's medical uses, community college classrooms, various entrepreneurial and startup kinds of companies where the rent could be quite low, to housing, and particularly housing for seniors, older residents, a cohort of demographics that's only going to grow. I've seen proposals for dementia centers dealing with the needs of older Americans with memory problems. So there are so many different kinds of things, I think.
But before I turn back to our guest in studio, what you're saying, June, because as you point to all the different possible uses, and malls in various places have become wetlands, as you mentioned, universities, community colleges, schools, churches, libraries, yes, medical facilities and research centers. But do you object to the idea that there doesn't have to be public subsidy or a public partnership or tax dollars involved?
Oh, there certainly doesn't have to be. I think there are many examples where you have a strong local market and demand, and those things are already happening. So those are the malls that have been successfully redeveloped in what we call to kind of mixed-use town centers, where there's been an increase in density, perhaps transit has been added or enhanced, and housing added, and really increasing the density in the property and also by extension, the tax benefit, the property taxes. But then there are countless other examples that maybe perhaps shouldn't have been built in the first place. And so there's another narrative here about possibly regreening. And you might need some public subsidy in order to offset the cost to demolish and restore the ecology, perhaps, because a lot of malls were built on filled wetlands. I've heard narratives of the space underneath. There's a mall that was demolished in Minnesota, where in order to inspect underneath the crawl space underneath, the land had subsided so much that they needed rowboats. So turning those back into park space that also could be doing this ecological function with managing stormwater is also a very interesting idea, which could, by extension, through some public investment in the open and park space, increase and improve and stabilize the property values of the houses and other things that are adjacent to the mall.
All right. So, George Conway, by the way, I'm with that description of malls being built on wetlands, I'm having a vision of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we built a castle and sank into the swamp.
Thanks.
So we built another castle, and it sank into the swamp. The third castle burned down, fell over, and sank,
into the swamp.
But the fourth mall is still here. Well, here we are with malls, and June's right. I mean, there are a lot of things that have already happened, and there's a lot of ideas out there. And she's saying it doesn't have to be public dollars related, but we're seeing in different places different incentives. How do you feel, generally speaking, in our community about incentives, whether it's the federal government and the Andrew Yang's plan, as Howard Decker points out, maybe $20 million on average per mall in the country, or some other plan of subsidy?
Oh, I think incentives and subsidies are terrible. I think they distort. I think if we listen to June's example, she says, well, a lot of these malls were built with incentives, i.e. Accelerated depreciation. They were built in flimsy fashion. I'll credit her with all that. I don't know. But they were built with incentives, and it was a bad idea. Now we have all these malls. But if we just give the right incentives, so government incentives weren't right then, but this time it's different. And if I had a nickel for every time I heard this time is different, I'd have 50 cents or something like that.
Well, why can't government say we got it wrong before, but now we've learned a lot?
Governments are run by humans, and humans are often wrong. And in my opinion, this is my opinion, I may be the only one in the room, I think they're wrong as often as they're right, at least. And when you subsidize, you distort an economic system that is otherwise very democratic. You have a dollar, you spend it. That dollar is your vote. You have $2, you spend that. Those dollars are your votes. When you have the feds or your local government spending your dollars as their vote, much less democratic.
Before I turn to Howard, let me just paint a scenario then. Let's say we've got a local mall, and I'm not going to pick any individuals because there's a lot of different things that could happen at our malls. Wilmer Wright's the general property owner in this case, and they're not here on the panel today, though we did have a good conversation with Dennis Wilmot not too long ago about the future of malls. And they're trying to be creative, and they understand what the landscape looks like. But if there is a community college, or if there is a senior living facility, or if there is, you know, co-op space or any of these ideas that June has brought up, and you're the owner of a mall, you know, and you're thinking about what you're going to do with this, you know, or flip it, I'm sorry, you're the person who wants to go into this space that is essentially growing weeds with a massive parking lot, why would government not say, look, we'll try to bolster this deal to get this thing done. We don't want this becoming a blight. We don't want it, as Andrew Yang says, to become a sinkhole.
Well, there are a couple of reasons, as we were discussing beforehand. The idea that these things will happen, maybe not today, but without the subsidies, it will happen anyway if there's real demand for it. The other
issue,
if the space fits, if there's demand, if senior housing, whatever it might be. But then there's the idea of, how about this company over here that's building their own senior housing? Now someone who happens to be politically connected, I won't mention the Wilmots, they are politically connected. I think they're great people. And I think they'd be great people doing good things without our tax dollars. And I'd rather have them be great people doing things, great things without our tax dollars. You compete with those people who are spending their own money. We had the huge example right over here, right behind us, High Falls, when a couple of administrations ago, the city poured lots of money into restaurant and bars here, and all the East End restaurant and bars that were trying to compete were kind of crying foul, saying, look, we're paying taxes. You guys are paying our competitors.
And the market didn't go there anyway.
The market didn't go there anyway, and that money was wasted.
And by the way, we're sitting here in High Falls, and that still stuns me because it's the best place in the city. But George is right. They couldn't even get people to go there, and all of those establishments eventually closed. But George, you're saying that when companies, whether it's, and again, not to pick on Wilmorite, but whether it's Wilmorite or anybody else, says, look, we wanted a pilot, we wanted a subsidy to get this done, and it wouldn't have happened without that government help. You're saying most of that you think is baloney?
I'd say, I want ice cream. Nobody's bringing me ice cream. Just because you want a subsidy doesn't mean you should get it. And the fact is that if you don't get it, you will either find some other way to do the deal, because you want to do a deal, or eventually you'll sell that building. If you perceive there's no demand, that building will sell for less. And because it's worth less, someone who's buying it will have invested less capital and have more to use to convert it to what they
sure,
want.
Sure. I think Andrew Yang is saying in this particular case, American malls are perhaps unique in their size and in the sort of the blight they can cause if they are unfilled. That's what represents the emergency that does rise to the level of needing subsidy.
I don't see it as an emergency. I mean, Medley Center is no emergency. It's a too bad thing. You got this big empty building, but I don't see it as any terrible blight. You drive by it and look at it and say, gee, that's too bad. Your life isn't changed because Medley Center is empty.
Okay, Howard Decker. Now, let's take a look at some of what June talked about. When you hear about what could happen with these massive parking lots that you have no affinity for, with these retail shopping complexes, she's talking about a range of things, community colleges, schools, libraries, medical facilities. Do these light you up? Is that what you want to see?
I have no problem with a mall being reinvented to accommodate senior housing or schools or whatever it can be used for. That's great. I don't think that we need necessarily to spend a lot of federal money making that happen. And as June and her partner, Ellen Dunham Jones, have pointed out so clearly to us, it's happening anyway. So we should just say this is great. As the world turns, these things will change. They will be altered. They will adapt, and they will become something else. And I don't think that we need to spend $6 billion to do anything except to observe that they are, in fact, in the process of changing. The real question here is, what is motivating Andrew Yang? I found myself wondering, why is he proposing such a thing as this kind of all of the things that our cities need, if we look at our school systems, for example, or if we look at all of the problems that our cities face? Your first hour was about our municipal services. If we look at all of the problems that cities face, why would Andrew Yang pick malls to be the place where he wanted to make some kind of statement about urban policy? And I just found it very strange. I thought to myself, well, let's see. The malls came at the expense of our downtowns and our small towns and villages, sometimes our cities. And a lot of retail stores were closed as a result because they moved to the mall. A lot of tax revenue was lost because the mall took. And now we're seeing yet another shift in American life. People are shopping differently. Our patterns of living have changed. The mall is not a pattern which fits the way in which we live our lives these days. And so we're going to move on. Is Andrew Yang proposing that we go back and give the subsidies, the grants, and the incentives to rebuilding our main streets, which were killed by the malls in the first place? No. And so it's all very curious. It doesn't really add up. I think it's fine. And I think of when I hear June talking, I think of the Congress of New Urbanism, who advocates a very broad and thoughtful policy towards the reuse and the adaptive reuse of these kinds of facilities to accommodate all kinds of walkable, pedestrian-oriented uses. And I think that's great. I'm just very skeptical about whether or not we federal taxpayers need to pay a $6 billion amount to save a mall.
June, you want to rebut that? Go ahead. Yeah.
I want to jump in here because when I first heard about this, I was a little puzzled as well. But I think one of the key pieces here in the puzzle is about jobs and how Americans are employed. And the mall isn't just a place that we visit and shop. It's where a lot of people work. and have been working increasingly over the years. And those jobs are disappearing. And so they're associated with these particular locations. And it's the malls, but it's the big boxes, and it's the chain food stores and so forth. And so these sort of low-paying service retail jobs on which many people are relying are at risk, not just because the malls are closing, but also because of shifts in how we get goods and how a lot of that stuff is being automated. So I think he's really onto something in terms of that question. It's one of six challenges for retrofitting suburbia that Ellen and I have identified, along with retrofitting for public health, for thinking about the aging society. And so I think that's another key piece here, combined with some ecological questions. So we're not going to kind of build our way out of this with new construction further and further out in the fringes. So this square footage is all about potential, I think, to rethink the place of ordinary folks in our economy.
June, let me read something that CityLab keyed in on, one of the challenges here as we look at malls. And by the way, I'm getting a lot of interest from listeners about whether George was fibbing, and maybe he actually is Lonely Medley Center, which is tweeting all hour, by the way. What a coincidence, Convoy.
Shocking.
but let me also say to listeners, you know, we've heard some feedback as well, and if you want to weigh in on what you expect the future of malls to be. I mean, I don't think we're going to see the shopping mall in its current form or in its more recent form for a whole lot longer, just because of the way human trends have gone with how we buy things and how we structure our lives, as Howard Decker said. But maybe you feel differently. We'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program, connections at WXXI.org. June, CityLab points out one hurdle here, because if we're going to repurpose these things, they write that economic incentives alone aren't enough to resuscitate disused malls and shopping centers. Yang zeroed in on the parking lot factor, a major impediment to rethinking these commercial sites. The zoning for malls often won't allow for anything but big box retail, end quote. And June, what that says to me is often we look at the building in the mall, but we see the ocean of parking, and we think, well, we got the parking. What else are we going to put there? Instead of sort of reimagining the whole site. So what do you do with that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things here. One is the amount of acreage that is tied up in these malls is quite astounding. I think we did a calculation at one point, Ellen and I, that these sort of roughly 300 malls, if on average that represents a footprint in land area equal to the size of the city of Boston, spread across the 50 states in the country. So that's a phenomenal amount of land to think about. And I would imagine that some of this federal funding could be used as a revolving loan kind of scenario, so that there would be a return on the investment, but also for planning. For good planning, regional planning. And so, again, it's very local. If you have a mall that killed a downtown, then that should be taken into consideration. There are other malls, especially in the South and West, that were built in communities where there was no previous downtown or Main Street. So the mall was it. So all of those kind of local factors, I think, need to be taken into consideration. And the role of planning and planners, we talked about humans, that there are humans in the private sector, there are humans in the public sector, there are humans making decisions, I think, all across the landscape here. But the role of investing in good planning, where there's community input and a conversation about the future of each region, town, suburb, city, I think is crucial.
Yeah, Howard, I'm sure you're going to want to weigh in there, because she hit a number of points. Planning for the future, community planning, and also looking at the impact on Main Street. I mean, do you blame malls for the impact on American Main Streets?
Partially, yes. I you can't help but partially blame the mall for that. But I think also the way in which we shopped was shifting. There were cars all around us in increasing numbers, and that was changing. There were a lot of other things that were changing at the same time that the malls came into being, which enabled the malls to do what they did to Main Street. But You asked another question. What was the other question you asked?
Well, I mean, it's about community planning.
I think, you know, the communities have to plan anyway. They should be planning anyway. And here's a fact. There's a guy named Chuck Marone. Maybe you know about Chuck. He runs an organization called Strong Towns. And Chuck lives in a little town called Brainerd, Minnesota. And Chuck did a little investigation, and he said, you know, there's 9 blocks in my city, my community of Brainerd, Minnesota, and I looked at the tax revenue that those 9 blocks generated, and then I compared that tax revenue to any and all retail land uses in the vicinity of my city. Big box, strip centers, malls, he looked at all of them. The little 9 blocks in his little city of Brainerd generated 287% more tax revenue than any of the retail facilities. So good planning would say, yeah, we really need to think about planning our cities in ways which make sense, which are walkable, which are pedestrian-oriented, which are mixed use. And these are conversations which are taking place all over the place. And they surely need to be taking place in the minds of the developers who own and operate malls. And if they're not thinking along those lines, then we shouldn't be too surprised that the malls are failing, because that's what people are interested in.
You also point out, Howard, that, you know, a lot of people may think, well, if malls fail, we're going to lose a big tax engine.
No, that's just not the case. And you can look wherever you'd like. Here's my favorite example. Eastview Mall, they have a payment in lieu of taxes. It's for 30 years. It's for $65 million. Do you realize what this means? This means that Eastview Mall is paying every year taxes to the grand total of $2.2 million. These facilities are not generating giant taxes for the communities in which they're located. And for us to think that they are is foolishness. They're just not. So, I'm with June. I worry about low-paying jobs at $10 an hour below minimum wage and so on. That's as much a problem on Monroe Avenue as it is at Marketplace Mall. I mean, we face these kinds of issues and challenges everywhere. So a lot of what she's talking about, and I think has to happen, are challenges that we face everywhere in our communities, not just with respect to malls.
You want to weigh in, too. Do you agree with Howard's point there, George, regarding the concern that we're going to be losing these tax engines?
I agree that we aren't losing very much in the way of tax engines. There may be malls somewhere that are paying plenty of taxes. I don't know of any.
Because historically, government tends to hand out pilot
agreements. The developer goes and says, look at this beautiful thing we're building, and even though we're not going to pay you property taxes, all those guys working at JCPenney are going to pay taxes, and isn't it going to be wonderful? And they shell out and give them a tax break or incentive of some kind. It's not a huge moneymaker for municipalities.
They say, and if you don't give us a payment in lieu of taxes, we might go broke. So we're being held hostage in a way in the first place. So that makes it even more reasonable for us to be skeptical about bailing them out.
Yeah, let them go broke. But if they go broke, they won't be able to pay campaign contributions. That's a problem.
Oh, man. I don't mean to laugh at that. let me do this. We're going to get a couple of phone calls. Pam in Newark, Owen in Brighton. We're coming to you after our only break of the hour. I'm glad to say we've convinced June to stay on with us. June Williamson is on the line with us, Chair of Architecture and Associate Professor in the Bernard and Ann Spitzer School of Architecture at City College of New York. You just heard George Conboy, Chairman of Brighton Securities, Howard Decker, Board Member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. We're talking about the future of American malls, piggybacking off of a CityLab piece analyzing Andrew Yang's proposal to spend $6 billion federal tax dollars to help repurpose roughly 300 dying American malls, which should be closed in the next 4 years, according to many an analyst who've taken a look at this. So what are we going to do with malls? What should we do? And do you want your tax dollars involved? We're back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, it's the launch of our Summer of Food series. Every Thursday, a conversation about trends, people, and places in the local food industry. We'll sit down with Kevin McCann of McCann's Meats. It's become an institution in Rochester, even in a world where veganism is on the rise. He's certainly a meat eater, but he's lost a lot of weight. His remarkable story, Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Owen and Brighton first on the phones. Go ahead, Owen.
Hi. So my question was, I'm a nurse up at Rochester General Hospital, and the huge problem that we always see is homelessness and people not being able to get their resources. Why shouldn't we be using these malls to temporarily house the homeless? There's plenty of space for them to put in social work offices. We know that they have the food courts, so they'd be able to cook for them. It seems like a good repurposing where we could get social work jobs that are actually helping build the community rather than just trying to sustain these big box office stores.
Owen, thank you. I'm going to start with June on that. Is that a solution you like, June?
I think if where there's a need in a local community, it's a perfectly appropriate solution. And there is one mall in the Washington, D.C. area that was converted into a shelter for homeless families. So, Owen, you might look that up. It's been published. I think one of the challenges there, though, is that the large footprint of these buildings, you don't have access to windows and natural ventilation as you would desire in a residential use. So you'd have to cut in some skylights or in other ways adapt the actual physical building. And now I'm speaking as an architect to accommodate more than just a short-term stay. But it's certainly a viable kind of use for the right properties.
Okay. Definitely. Howard Decker, do you like this solution?
It's fine with me. I'm not sure I'd like to have the homeless out in the suburbs, in the fields.
Where malls tend to be.
Where the parking lots. But
Living in suburbs, in the suburbs are living in poverty and living in their cars in many
parts. And in Rochester, we know that we have one of the poorest cities in America, and we also know that we have one of the poorest suburban areas in America, the sixth poorest suburban area in America. So I'm certainly not suggesting that we don't have poverty in the suburbs. What I am suggesting is whether or not I'm questioning whether or not we want to have homelessness housed in a facility like a mall. It is possible to imagine altering the mall, as June is suggesting, so that it could work, but...
Okay. George Conboy.
No, I wouldn't go for that. Very expensive, as June implies. I run a business that 70 years ago was a department store. And over those 70 years, we transformed that building into office space. It took a long time for us to occupy all of it. But it wasn't well-suited as office space a long time ago. It is finally now, but a very expensive proposition for little societal benefit.
Okay. Certainly the issue of homelessness, you know, might need some government addressing. You're saying this is an inefficient way to do it.
I think it's a very inefficient way to do it. You're closing prisons. You've got those buildings.
Okay. Pam in Newark next. Go ahead, Pam.
I think this whole conversation is kind of like, why bother? Because if we have climate change going on, and I believe the scientists that we do, we're living in it, and they say that the best thing we can do is plant trees in every space there is. Why don't we just plant trees instead of putting more cars in somewhere, turning that into something else, and having people argue over which is the best thing to do with this? We can just, they're all built on swamp, so we can just plant trees there instead. There's trees that grow in swamp.
All right, Pam, thank you. June Williamson, I'll start with you. What do you make of that?
Well, I think in some locations with some malls that perhaps there are certainly malls that were built with the tax subsidies and others that were never profitable or just barely profitable. But if they were built on filled wetlands, I think that could be a great opportunity to leverage some government funds to clean up those properties and transform them into stormwater parks, for example. And there's going to be a case study in our next book, Meriden Green, which used to be the Meriden Hub Mall in Connecticut, that flooded catastrophically frequently. Not only the mall property flooded, but blocks all around it. So by demolishing the mall, regrading, that is cutting basically a lower elevation for where the mall used to be, making a park. And there's a creek that goes through there normally, but if they ever have a flood in the larger kind of watershed in the river, that park will fill up and become like a pond temporarily, and it'll save blocks and blocks around it from where there are still buildings from incurring damage. So that's a good investment. And I think there are other similar examples that have to do with the local topography and the nature of the actual ground itself that the mall was built on, for which this would make a lot of sense.
Okay. Certainly this is one that would involve the use of some public money because of the public acquisition of the land and the repurposing of it.
But then the benefit, because you have a park.
Okay. Howard Decker, what do you think?
I think, as I said earlier, and I would reiterate, we're on the point of so many very substantial changes in the way in which we lead our lives. And a caller is right that one of the principal motivators of the change in our lives will be environmental, will be global warming, if you want to call it that. It's quite complicated, but it's going to affect our lives in profound ways and cause us to change the way we live. We are on the verge of seeing cars go away, or at least certainly to change fundamentally.
Are we in one of your dreams again?
We are, and we're going to have a chance to talk about this again later on, I'm sure. But so many aspects of our lives are in the middle of really radical, major, revolutionary changes. Pardon me. And I think malls are certainly not immune to that. June and her partner said that we should re-rent malls, and then we should reinvent malls, and then we should remove malls. And that's some of her some of June's latest examples were in the removal column. And I think that's a perfectly good three-part plan for how to deal with malls. I just have to come back and say, given all that we face, given all the challenges that we face in contemporary American life, I'm not sure that I want to spend $6 billion to fix malls.
Okay. George Conboy?
It's 1:42, July 10th. You should write down that Howard and I agree. Might be the only time, but I certainly agree. It's a complete lunatic plan and waste of money. But the idea that June talks about of a public benefit, I'd like public benefits to be decided by the public, not a small group of contribution-seeking public officials working with small groups of development people or small groups of planners. Planners have emotion. They want what's good for me. Howard doesn't want me to have a car. I don't want that, right? You know what I like about what Yang had to say? There's one thing I like about what Yang had to say. Quote in his position paper, capital doesn't care about us. Now, that says capital. It's cold. It's mean. I look at that and I say, I love that. Someone who cares about me wants to tell me what to do for my own good. I'll take capital. Thank you.
See, you're back to disagreeing.
Yes, we are.
That was fast. And I want to get back to your phone calls. So let me go next to Douglas in Rochester. Go ahead, Doug.
Hi. I lived much of my life in Victor's, so I'm familiar with the Eastview Mall situation. And yes, $65 million sounds like about the expense of constructing that major wing on the mall, which includes Lord & Taylor and so forth. And the rationale by the town board at the time was that if that in lieu of taxes arrangement was not made, that large wing would not be built. And, of course, that's a value judgment, would it or would it not be built. That was in the control of the developer. But it's not as if there were a subsidy of public dollars poured into that. Rather, instead of receiving the full amount of taxes as if it were already there, a lesser amount was agreed upon so that payment, that reduction, would then be steered to paying off the bondholders. And, of course, they drove it in part because they needed to be assured that they would be repaid. The other rationale for that is sales taxes. If none of that wing had been built, there would be no stores there. There would be no sales tax revenue, which is substantial. And I have been told that because of Eastview Mall, primarily, that the town of Victor covers about one-third of the Ontario County budget. It's a very strong economic engine. And these are sales taxes dedicated to Ontario County. If the sales taxes were utilized by something like eBay, if somebody wants to instead go to a store in that wing and buy the same product on eBay, well, it's only been June 1st that eBay has begun charging sales tax to people, to purchasers, and those sales taxes go to the state. They do not go to the county involved. So it seems rational that this particular in lieu of taxes arrangement was made. It has been a great benefit to the town of Victor for the sales tax division that goes to the town and to the county. The county would be in a much worse position without that.
All right, Douglas, thank you. Howard Decker, go ahead.
I think that what Doug is telling us about is a perfect illustration of the way in which it's supposed to work. The developers and owners of the mall are working with the community and the county, and together they found a way to make it all come together in a way which everybody thinks is positive. And I have to say that a payment in lieu of taxes is, in fact, a major subsidy. But nonetheless, notwithstanding, it seems to me that that sounds to me like an equation that works. And the federal government is not in the middle of that equation. So what I see is that local governments and counties and developers, property owners, can come together and they can work out whatever they can work out without necessarily invoking federal grants and incentives to make these programs work. And that's, I mean, it's already been working in hundreds of instances, as June has pointed out, across the United States. By their count, by the count of June and Ellen, somewhere near 700 of these have been reused. So I think it's working pretty well. Sometimes it doesn't work so great. We really do need to pay attention to it, but I don't think it needs federal intervention of any kind.
So let me read a comment from a listener, and I apologize. I don't know the name of the listener who sent this. Reading off, someone texted my email, so I can't read who wrote this, but says, Evan, what they should do with malls is turn them into mini cities for the elderly. You could have restaurants, you could have hair salons, you could have a dentist, you could have doctor's offices. You can have all that stuff within the complex where the people live. June, you know, I mean, in some sense, that's being done, or at least proposed in some places. What do you think?
It definitely is being done, and it's one of the sort of challenges that suburbs in general are facing, and many malls were built in suburbs, not all of them. And so there's a huge desire of the folks to age in place is one term, but there's also aging in community. So maybe people won't be able to stay in their detached house where they can't get around without driving, but to be able to move in or near the mall in what's called a naturally occurring retirement community, which we have increasing numbers of examples around the country where people who might have moved in their houses 30, 40, 50 years ago and they're still there, to have these new uses or maybe even new, more supportive residential options at the mall where they can go for a daily walk and get coffee with their friends and maybe take a class at the community college and get access to their routine medical care. And if they happen to develop dementia, there's a memory center for them that's safe and easy to get to. All of these things make a lot of sense. And the mall can be a central kind of hub for this activity, and then add transit or little mini mini shuttles to get people around to where they might need to go. It really is a very attractive formula, I think. One thing I did wanted to add in terms of the discussion earlier about what Yang's motivations might have been, mm-hmm. I think traditionally a lot of politics in the discussion has pitted cities against suburbs or against rural areas. And I think there's a potential here for a unifying kind of narrative where the kinds of challenges, economic challenges that ordinary families are facing are distributed across the built landscape, I think, in this country. And it's not either or. It's a kind of both-and proposition.
Sure. And I would just observe that, you know, I think Andrew Yang, and again, I've done a lot of speaking for people in these 2 hours. I try not to do that. But I would assume he would say he's trying to be forward-looking and be realistic about the economy. He talks about automation. He talks about UBI. He talks about, you know, the future of the way that we shop and we live. Whereas Donald Trump, maybe even Joe Biden, they might tell you they're going to bring a mall back, or they're going to, you know, there's been a lot of talk about going back and bringing mills back and mines back and malls. Maybe malls would come back. Who knows? I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, June, is there any scenario where you could see malls existing into the future? At least let's go 25 to 50 years from now, the way they have in the last 25 years.
I think the short answer is no. I think another factor here is how over-retailed we've been in the United States. And the latest figures show we still have 23 square feet of shopping space per capita in this country. That's astonishing. Every man, woman, and child has their own little store, practically, not to mention all the parking spaces devoted to servicing that retail.
But I don't know how to evaluate whether that's a problem or if that's appropriate.
Canada is 16. The largest in Europe, in the UK, is 4.5 square foot per person. So we're five times that.
11 times more than Germany.
Yeah.
9 times more than Italy.
So on and so forth, yeah.
4 times more than Japan.
The
six
democratization
times more than
of shopping here means prices are lower and availability is greater for nearly anything, and I'm sure you've tried shopping in those countries. I certainly have.
So,
well, it's also the shopping, the buildings themselves are overscaled, I think, for the actual amount of even
they are now with the advent of Amazon, but they weren't at one time. Although I agree with you with the idea
they
of
always 20, were.
25 years from now, the idea of the mall being existing the way it's existing now. I think you'll still have some if people want to go and feel and touch and look at the product and have a selection in front of them. But it'll be much, much smaller as delivery gets faster and quicker and cheaper.
I mean, where are people going to go
on
Christmas Eve when they have not made any plans, George? But June, you were talking about experience. I mean, that is one thing. I mean, I've got an email from someone saying, are we really losing malls? This person's saying, I still like going to malls. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's I think, shifting towards, first of all, experiences, and then the other, it could be services that aren't necessarily buying goods, but whether it's entertainment type services or health related experiences, wellness, exercise, education and taking classes, all sorts of kinds of experiences that bring people together is important.
So what it comes down to is that shopping malls used to be destinations for shopping, and now they're becoming destinations for something else. Some of them are just
could be
vaporizing, but some of them are becoming destinations for entertainment, seniors, community centers, libraries, colleges, you know, lots of different kinds of other destinations. So
for as long as we need that.
Yeah,
with the massive online course thing, will we need as much university space? Maybe not. Will we need all the big community colleges if it can be done online? Maybe not.
And I think,
but the market can determine that.
What June was saying when Evan asked the question, will they be here in 50 years, was basically no, and that's basically true, because basically the way we shop and acquire what we need for our daily lives is changing radically. And so, of course,
yeah,
it's going to be something
else. And as a corollary to that, as the architect here, the buildings will fall down.
Well, so June, I'm glad you bring this up, because I wanted to hit this before the hour was out. George, earlier in the program, invoked the local mall we've been joking about. It's called Medley Center. It used to be called Irondequoit Mall. It is empty. The pictures in there, it is quite something what it has become. Nature is an amazing beast that takes over a mall over the years. And, you know, so it's been the way of the wild there. And it's a big, empty mall. And it's a gorgeous mall by mall standards, but it is a big, empty mall. George, your contention is, so what? We drive by it, no big deal, whatever.
So what? Kodak blew up all kinds of buildings, so what? We don't sit here saying, gee, we should have kept those buildings.
Okay.
If there's no use for them, blow them up.
Okay,
plant some grass seeds.
So June, what I'm asking is, do you agree with that? Do you agree that if we've got hundreds of malls that do that in this country, well, so what? That's just, you know, that's just one chunk of property in our communities, in hundreds of places, and if that's the way they go, that's the way they go. Do you view it that way, June?
Well, I think the property is all potential. It's been urbanized. It's been disturbed. So I think there's an obligation within any community to think about that land as an asset. And so to just kind of leave it to fall down on its own and kind of drive by it and ignore it, I think, is not responsible land stewardship. And I think any development that might come in, whether it's a school or more housing, I think there's an obligation to look at the potential to reuse that already urbanized and disturbed land before going to the outskirts and greenfields. And as the caller earlier, Pam, talked about, we don't want to be clear-cutting any forest, filling any more natural kind of ecological assets in our communities and sprawling out further. So can we kind of direct any development of any kind to potentially use these land assets?
I'm happy to let capital direct it, because capital doesn't care. people who care are going to do things that other people don't want.
There's people behind capital making decisions based on their own values, I think, about what's appropriate or what isn't. And so I think across the landscape, there are people making decisions, I think.
People who own assets should decide to use those assets to their own best use. And over time, capital will allocate what people want. After all, we subsidized railroads for years. Then they all went bankrupt because we had cars and trucks. And then when we finally get the jetpacks, they promised us in 1962 we won't need as many cars and trucks. Until I get the jetpack, I'm not going away from the cars.
Well, Howard, I know you want to jump in before the hour's up. Go ahead, Howard Decker.
Well, I was just going to say that June, as a fellow architect and urban designer, I agree that these resources are time-sensitive. They're going to fall down, so we've got to figure out what to do with them. I also think that they're resources. They are sunk costs. We need to think about what they represent in terms of how we've kind of dealt with them. And so it's right for us to come together as communities and say, what should happen here? I just don't think that, and I'm certainly agreeing with June that that kind of thoughtfulness is appropriate. I just don't believe that that thoughtfulness requires $6 billion in federal incentive. I think that that kind of thoughtfulness should happen no matter what, given the kind of challenges that we face.
I want to thank all of our guests, and I'll ask you this, Howard Decker, not for work purposes, just for recreation. When's the last time you were in a mall?
It's been a while.
Can't remember.
I can't.
George Conboy.
Years.
Been years. June?
I go all the time for research.
For research, see? That's for work. June, I really appreciate you taking the time for the hour for us, and it's been my pleasure having you. Thanks for your time and your expertise this hour.
Thank you. You're welcome.
June Williamson is the Chair of Architecture and Associate Professor in the Bernard and Ann Spitzer School of Architecture at City College of New York. Howard Decker is an architect, a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. He's coming for George's car. He hasn't gotten it yet. Thanks for being here, Howard.
Thanks very much, Evan. George, watch your car.
I'll watch them all.
George Conboy is the Chairman of Brighton Securities. Thank you, George. Nice having you. And somebody is Lonely Medley Center, who's been listening and tweeting. And I'm coming for you. I don't know who you are, but you're going to be. That's going to be the big get on Connections. If we can't get the mayor of Rochester, we're going to get Lonely Medley Center. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. Thank you to Don, the volunteer, and I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.